America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And how did this great nation get that way? Well, there's a new book that says it got that way as a matter of inheritance, not inheritance in the genetic sense, but inheritance in the cultural sense, in inheriting a system of ideas, attitudes, approaches, values that we got from the mother country along with other English-speaking nations. The new book is called Inventing Freedom, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World. The author is Daniel Hannan, and if you watch Fox News at all, you've probably seen a great deal of Mr. Hannan. He is a member of the European Parliament. He is a member of the Tory Party, the Conservative Party in Great Britain. He has represented Southeast England for the Conservative Party since 1999. Mr. Hannan, great to speak to you. And great to speak to you, and congratulations on the book.
Hi.
Hi, you can hear me.
Yes, I can hear you now. Okay. Yes, thank you.
Terrific. The book Inventing Freedom talks about the ideas that have helped to make the English-speaking nations around the world among the most successful and admired nations anywhere. And all you need to do is think about nations from Canada to the United States, to Australia, to New Zealand, to increasingly to Ireland. And those nations are all part of what at one time was the British Empire. Your argument for people who want to say it's racist, right, that it's based upon some kind of notion of Anglo-Saxon superiority, couldn't you use Nelson Mandela as an example of why that has nothing to do with the argument in Inventing Freedom?
Oh, very much so. I mean, the Anglosphere is why Bermuda is not Haiti, and why Hong Kong is not China, and why Singapore is not Indonesia. I mean, the Anglo-Saxons, if you like, have never been a majority, or not since the very early days of the settler population of North America. This is everything to do with structures and nothing to do with inheritance. And I think South Africa is a good example. The biggest riots during the apartheid era were in the 70s and were protests against the attempt to impose Afrikaans as a joint language alongside English in schools. Black South Africans understood then intuitively that English was a language of liberation and modernity, and Afrikaans was a language of oppression and tyranny. And although we now remember the transition from apartheid to multi-party democracy as a moment of liberation for Black South Africans, which of course it was, it was no less a liberation for English-speaking South Africans. It was a move away from a socialist, controlled, introverted apartheid state into a state that took its place within the wider community of law-based English-speaking democracies.
1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. The book is called Inventing Freedom, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World. We've posted it very proudly on our website at michaelmedved.com, and it would make a fascinating and wonderful and very welcome Christmas gift for anybody who wants to be illuminated by the book by Daniel Hannan. I discovered something reading your book, Mr. Hannan, that I hadn't known. And you write that in 1955, in a little chronicled assertion of Anglosphere values, Anglosphere meaning English-speaking people's values, 30,000 English-speaking South Africans signed the Natal Covenant, rejecting the apartheid state that the Afrikaners were establishing and pledging their loyalty to the Queen and Commonwealth. Wasn't South Africa at some point thrown out of the Commonwealth because of apartheid?
Yes, it was, and it was a rather pleasing demonstration of what the Anglosphere stands for, the idea of elevating the individual above the state and the law above the government, that when democracy and majority rule returned, one of the first acts of the democratic South African government was to rejoin the Commonwealth.
Yeah, and you also make the point that the National Party, the old Afrikaner Party, the Apartheid Party, that F.W. de Klerk helped to lead the country away from, that that particular party was basically socialist, which is why it may have been more sympathetic to the National Socialists in Germany during the war.
It had been. I mean, one of the points that is often made about this, you know, because a lot of conservatives saw South Africa during the 70s and 80s completely in Cold War terms, some people who would be broadly sympathetic to the conservative movement made a really bad call, and they ended up gritting their teeth and supporting a rotten, racist, and oppressive regime for what seemed to them grounds of realpolitik. They thought that a majority rule South Africa would become communist. Now, obviously, that turned out not to be true, but the fact that some conservatives were on the wrong side of that argument can blind us to the huge truth, which is that really what killed apartheid was capitalism. A system like that, which is based on segregation, on privileging certain people, and on protecting state assets, cannot survive the logic of the free market, which treats every individual as a free agent, as a consumer or a producer. Capitalism is naturally colorblind. It's the most brilliantly non-racist, non-sectarian system because it allows people who may have nothing else in common to come together for mutually productive ends. And that system of capitalism, that idea of contract-based ownership, was something that basically was developed in the English-speaking world and exported to other places. And I think it has raised our species to a level of wealth and prosperity that would have been undreamed of recently.
1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. Speaking with Daniel Hannan, author of Inventing Freedom. Mr. Hannan, I know that there are people out there who are listening to us and saying, well, what are you talking about, Medved? You and your guests sound crazy. We keep hearing that Great Britain and Canada and maybe to a somewhat lesser extent Australia and many other countries, aside from the United States, in the Anglosphere are already socialist countries. How can you identify Anglo-Saxon English-speaking people's ideas as capitalist when so many Anglosphere countries have, quote, gone socialist?
Yes, I'm not sure we have gone socialist. I'm not sure that your country or mine is really the best example of Anglosphere values at the moment. But I would still rather live in our system, under our rules, than under anybody else's. For this reason, although the state continues to grow, it's true, your federal government has enlarged enormously, our government has, the Canadian and so on. In every case, the private sector continues to outgrow them. And this is why I'm fundamentally optimistic, and this, I think, will put me at odds with a number of conservatives on both sides of the Atlantic, but human ingenuity is limitless. For all of the mistakes and all of the badly allocated resources run by governments, the private sector is always several steps ahead. And I look forward to a pretty good future for the U.S. with, you know, driverless cars and additive and subtractive manufacturing and amazing technological advances in healthcare and genetic technology and so on. Life will continue to get better as long as the inventiveness of a free people is allowed to be given its free rein. Our system, elevating as it does the individual, is perfectly suited to the internet age. And I'm pretty optimistic about the future of the Anglosphere, not as a federation or anything like that. I mean, you know, I've been in the European Parliament for 15 years. Heaven knows I've had enough of common currencies and international bureaucracies. But as a network of allied nations bound together by values and by commerce.
What about the New World Order? American conservatives, many American conservatives seem to be obsessed with fears about the New World Order. You work with the European Union. You're a member of the European Parliament. How's that New World Order going?
Right. Yeah, you only have to put the question, don't you? The policy of transferring more and more powers from elected national representatives to supranational technocracies doesn't just make you less democratic, it also makes you poorer. And that's where we've got to now. The money has run out in the Eurozone. They've run out of other people's resources. And although they, the Eurocrats themselves, have been shielded from the consequences of their own errors because Eurocrats don't pay tax. It's a little-known fact. Their salaries and pensions and so on are guaranteed. The price that is being inflicted on their peoples, the mass unemployment in Greece and Italy and Spain and Portugal, and the IOUs that are piling up in Germany and the Netherlands and Finland and so on to keep the euro going, are becoming colossal. And this is all being done because the Eurocrats won't admit that the euro was a mistake.
This is Daniel Hannan. He is the author of Inventing Freedom, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World. We will come right back with your calls for Daniel Hannan. He is a member of the European Parliament. He's a keen observer of American politics. And I also want to refer to, his invocation of Winston Churchill coming back and looking at the English-speaking world. He wrote, of course, famous for writing the history of the English-speaking peoples. What would Churchill be surprised at seeing and reassured if he were back today? That and more with your calls for Daniel Hannan coming up.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show.
Medved Show, there is so much fascinating material about South Africa, about the West Indies nations, about America, about Great Britain, about the entire Anglosphere. The book is called Inventing Freedom, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World. And Daniel Hannan, the author who's a member of the European Parliament, is our guest. Daniel, one of the things that I think is fantastic is at the very end of the book, is you say that we have seen that the story of the English-speaking peoples is the story of how they imposed their will upon all other nations. No, it doesn't say that. It says how they imposed their will upon their rulers. And that is such a crucial point and so well made. You also talk at the conclusion of the book about what Churchill might say and how he might respond. Were he able to come back among us these 50-plus years later, and his reaction would be?
Well, I think his real shock would be to see what a success India had become. He was not perfect. He got some things wrong, and one of the things he badly miscalled was India. He didn't believe that India would be capable of success as a self-governing country. In fact, India has been a model democracy, pretty much, since independence. There's never been a coup. Nobody's ever been exiled or shot in an election. The common law system has worked. Property is protected. There's a free market based on imposable contracts and an independent judiciary. And he would, I'm sure, argue that India should now be made a kind of core military ally and trading partner of the other English-speaking powers. Do you know, it's interesting. When you said it's the story of imposing our will on our rulers, we take things for granted. It's human nature. I do it, you do it, we all do it. What is easy to lose is just how exceptionally lucky we are, geographically and historically, to have evolved to live under a system where the rulers are in some way accountable to everyone else. You know, a medieval European monarchy would not have been so very different in its political structure from a modern African kleptocracy. The usual lot of humanity is oligarchy and tyranny. A small number of people get in, they rig the rules so that they continue to predate on everybody else and so that their kids enjoy the same advantage that they do. That has been human history in most places through the ages. Caste, hereditary privilege, and a organized plunder, taxation by a small caste of everybody else. We are so fortunate that we stumbled upon this miraculous idea that the law was above the government. And, you know, it sounds so obvious when you say it now, but what an amazing insight when our ancestors first had it. This thing that you couldn't see or touch or taste, but it was bigger than the king. It was bigger than the biggest guy in the tribe. It bound the strongest just as it bound the poorest. And that's been the foundation of modern free trade, specialization, capitalism, and all the things that have made us comfortable, wealthy, and free.
Let's go to David in Houston, Texas. David, you're on the Michael Medved Show with Daniel Hannan. David, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call, gentlemen. I really appreciate it. And I take great issue with a couple of the points that are being made. And the largest one is that there can be a case made for expanding government and at the same time and in the same breath make the case for perpetuating hope and personal freedoms. when you crush capitalism and when you expand the state, you reduce the level of hope for most people, because they see those systems that perpetuate themselves as tremendous obstacles, and with those obstacles, it takes away someone's inspiration to put in the perspiration to get the job done. And if you need to look no further than the number of patents that have been issued in the United States. Now, just in the last, 5 years, something dramatic happened, and that was the number of patents coming in or opening up in the United States were actually greater by people from outside this country. The intellectual property is being reduced as the state increases. And
okay, response, Daniel Hannan.
Well, I completely agree with David's point. I don't think we're on opposite sides of this one at all. Of course, as the government expands, it crushes freedom and enterprise, and it disincentivizes the perspiration, as David puts it. I absolutely agree with that. I'm simply making the point that you can maintain a free market system without making absolute cuts in spending. And a good example of this was Margaret Thatcher. I mean, I would love to have absolute cuts in spending. In a modern democracy, it's very difficult. Throughout the 1980s, in every single year, in absolute terms, the amount of money spent by the UK government increased. But in proportionate terms, it fell because the private sector outgrew the state so much. And that's why I'm basically optimistic. However useless and inept the government is, it's always playing catch-up. It can never regulate as quickly as we can invent. And whether the patents come from here or from the US or elsewhere, you know, the human ingenuity in the private sector is always going to be quicker than any government bureaucracy. And that's why, as long as you have a legal system that constrains the state and protects private property, you're going to be secure from socialism.
Let's go to Ken in Detroit, Michigan. Ken, you're on the Michael Medved Show with Daniel Hannan.
Yes, I was wondering now, William Tyndale's translation of the Bible for the first time into English from the original language, would you agree or disagree that this was a genesis in England for the understanding of the idea of freedom and liberty?
Yes, I would. I don't think it was the very first rendition into English, but it was the first one that was printed and that therefore was disseminated to a wider audience.
Well, I know it was the first from its original language.
John Wycliffe had translated the scriptures in the 14th century, but of course he didn't have a printing press. And, well, it depends what you mean by English, you know, that the language was evolving, but it had been translated into vernacular. But no, I totally agree. Once you disseminate the idea that we have a responsibility to read the scriptures for ourselves and to find our own relationship with our Maker, there is an immediate political implication from that, which is that we're also responsible for ourselves in secular affairs. Just as you're not going to be told what to do in ecclesiastical matters, so you're not going to be told what to do by princes or aristocrats. And I think that the spread of, if you like, personal responsibility was the basis of the spread of democracy. One of the fascinating things I discovered, possibly the single most surprising fact in the book, when Abraham Lincoln made his Gettysburg Address, we celebrated the 150th anniversary a couple of weeks ago. The famous closing words, government of the people, by the people, for the people, those words were not Lincoln's. His audience would have recognized their provenance, as our generation typically doesn't. They came from what I think was the first translation of the Bible into English by John Wycliffe. And incredibly, that phrase, government of, by, and for the people, was written in 1384. Now, is there any other language in the world where that thought could have been expressed at that time?
Certainly the thoughts expressed in beautiful English in Inventing Freedom are well worth considering. The book makes an outstanding Christmas gift. Daniel Hannan, I know that you have to run. I hope you will rejoin us, because there are literally millions of people out there who are eager to continue the conversation. The book, Inventing Freedom, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World. Now, coming back, we'll talk a little bit about the best and the worst prospects for future leadership, particularly leadership in the White House, and what we need to do to maximize the prospects of the people who are most worthy. Coming up.
The Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com.
Portions of the Michael Medved Show are sponsored by Wellspring Benefits Group. Learn how $19.95 per month can provide your family with a non-insurance healthcare option. Visit MedvedPlus.com.
34 minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show, where it's the holiday season. Of course, we're coming up to Christmas time, and that means that you want to get your place ready for all the visitors and ready for all the elegant entertaining you're going to be doing and so forth. And that means it's time to go to blinds.com. Maybe you're a little bit unsure about ordering blinds and actually measuring them yourself. Well, you know what? Blinds.com makes it so easy. They do it with their free online how-to videos and free expert advice. And in fact, if you do mismeasure anything and the blinds come in and you can't really put them up the way that you want, they'll remake them for you for free. So hurry, take advantage of amazing December deals with 10 to 25% off on top brands right now. Blinds.com, where prices crush home improvement store prices. Blinds.com. Daniel Hannan was talking about, some of the unique aspects of our civilization that are really a gift from going all the way back to the Magna Carta and before and traditional British ideals. And you see that so directly. And you see it particularly if you're recalling the death of Nelson Mandela and his great contribution. There are two questions, and this is something that I did on my MedHead Musing, which I think is a particularly important one. It's available to MedHead members who sign up for our premium website, which, by the way, makes a great Christmas gift. Great Christmas gift idea. You can give someone and send out a gift card as a MedHead membership for a year. In any event, the question is not only what made Nelson Mandela so unique and so distinctive, but what makes South Africa so different from the other countries on that continent. Now, think about it. This is a great big continent. There are more than 30 different countries on the continent. South Africa has lots of problems, lots of challenges, but it is by far and away the most prosperous, the most free, the only country on that continent that is doing reasonably well. Right now in the Central African Republic, there is an Islamic militia that has been terrorizing Christian churches and Christian individuals and cutting off heads and limbs and arms. And I don't know what's happening today. They just decided they're going to be sending about 1,200 French peacekeepers into the Central African Republic. It's a country of 4.7 million. But today is Friday, so in the Islamic world, there's probably going a little bit crazy there. But that's typical about so many countries in Africa. And yes, one of the reasons that South Africa came out so differently is because of Mandela, but it's also because it had a particularly long-standing and well-established connection with the British Commonwealth. And where South Africa got into trouble is where they broke that connection. They went in a strange Afrikaner, non, if you will, English-speaking Anglosphere direction. And the truth of the matter is that is part of what makes that country so very, very different from the countries surrounding it. Now, by the way, it's not just a question of population. It's a question about cultural influence. I just checked. The population today that is white in South Africa is 8.9%, which is really very, very small. I think it's smaller than most people even realize. And yet, the heritage, when Nelson Mandela was working as a lawyer, when he was a member of the firm, Mandela and Tambo, what part of what he was doing was studying, learning, understanding, coming to terms with, and to some extent embracing British common law and its traditions. Isn't that something that is worth preserving? 1-800-955-1776. And part of that preservation is going to involve the GOP presidential nomination. I mentioned before that Mike Huckabee is apparently being urged by a group of pastors to run for the GOP presidential nomination. There's a provocative piece by Karl Rove where he talks about exactly what someone should do if that person wants to become the GOP nominee. He says there are two bits of advice above all others that are necessary for a plan of action in the year 2014 if you want to get the Republican nomination in the year 2016. And he names a bunch of people and the importance of them taking that advice. If you have some advice that you would impart to a particular Republican candidate or to all Republican candidates, you can give us a call.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael Medved Show. That's 1-800-955-1776. We've been waiting for better benefits, no liberal agenda, no age limits. Go to beamericastrong.com.
And it's a great Christmas idea, too. If you give a charter membership to America Strong, it's the only across the board, all ages, conservative membership benefits organization. Go to beamericastrong.com. You sign them up. A friend of yours, a family member, anyone you want to give this great gift to, you can sign them up for savings up to 50% from over 300,000 merchants, all while fighting for conservative values. Go to Be America Strong and give a Christmas gift that keeps on giving. That's Be America Strong. And that's B as in B-E. All right, Karl Rove, we were talking about, has a piece where the headline, and this is for somebody who really does know politics, is the first steps to the 2016 GOP nomination. He says, look, it's really, really early right now. And he points out that in the polling in December of 2005, which would be the equivalent of where we are now for 2016, right? In other words, 3 years before the election of 2008. Who was the GOP front runner far and away? It was Rudy Giuliani. He wasn't really even a factor, as it turned out, in 2008. And Barack Obama, he wasn't even on the polls. Hillary Clinton exceeded all the other Democrats together, just as she does now. But none of it matters right now because it's still too early and there are too many things that can happen. 2014, however, could be crucial. The year is coming up, and he says there are two things that a serious contender has to do. One of them is, he says, you need to benefit from road testing themes, messages, and applaud lines. You need to avoid saying stupid things and reinforcing stereotypes in politics. Practice doesn't make perfect, but it does make better. What he's saying is people need to take out the show on the road, go campaign for other people who are on the ballot. Some of the contenders are going to be on the ballot themselves. Scott Walker is, John Kasich is, Susana Martinez, they're on the ballot. And he says they should use also the next year to give substantive speeches linking philosophy and policy and to broaden their fundraising networks and to figure out which staff members they want to keep around them. The other thing, he says, the first thing that every candidate has to do is make 2014 about something bigger, more important, and more inspiring than personal ambition. This will require presidential aspirants to promote bold ideas, identify with big causes, and exhaust themselves in raising money and enthusiasm for GOP candidates for Congress and governorships. I think he's right. Let's go to your calls and your advice for any potential GOP presidential nominee to Mike in Asheville, North Carolina. You're on the Medved Show.
Hello, Mike. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Thank you for having me on. The two things, and I think Mitt Romney really messed up on this, is on the debates, have less debates, and then this is more just for the Republicans, I guess, and do not have a debate without a conservative moderator on there. I think they really messed up on that last time. And the second thing would, I think they need to just show more compassion. I think people really look for that in regard to the poor and some of the other areas where
you are completely correct. I think that both of your points are excellent. This is the Arthur Brooks point, which is people favor in politics fighting for people rather than fighting for abstractions. And that's what Republicans have to show that we're about. Right now on Obamacare, it's not that we have an abstract or philosophical disagreement with Obamacare. It's that Obamacare is hurting people. It's lousing up lives. It's making life more burdensome and difficult and threatening and insecure for millions and millions of Americans. And we're trying to help. We're fighting for people. And in terms of too many debates, sure, there are too many debates. You can't always get to choose your moderator. But you certainly can choose, and I know that Reince Priebus, the Republican National Chair, has been trying to work on this. You can choose not to have 23 primary debates where people just have a chance to attack one another. That's not appropriate. Let's go to Shiloh in Salt Lake City. You're on the Michael Medved Show. Your advice.
Hi, Michael. My advice, well, first of all, Karl Rove is a smart guy. He and I share the same alma mater, and I think that generally what he's saying in the piece is correct. But I would also add, and this speaks to a point you brought up yesterday when you were talking about pornography, I think that for a voter like me, a young adult male, the social issues need to be less emphatically spoken out against. For example, Mike Huckabee being so closely aligned with the religious right, you know, I think that candidates like him run the risk of losing younger voters like me, because really social issues is where the Republican Party and I and conservatism and I diverge, because I'm in favor of shrinking government. I'm in favor of government, as you said yesterday, being less intrusive in our personal lives. But it seems like conservatives are hypocritical about that, because...
Well, let me just ask you, which social issues do you hear being trumpeted and emphasized in conservative media right now or by conservative politicians?
Well, gay marriage, for instance.
It's hardly talked about, because basically, you know why? Because all of the states that are going to legalize gay marriage have done so, and the other 30 states that haven't won't. And I don't think that gay marriage should be or will be an important federal issue unless the Democrats try to draw us into that trap.
And I hope they don't, because I voted for Barack Obama in both elections, and I don't regret, well, I do now. Retrospectively, I wish I could take my vote back.
Good.
This last election.
Good.
I really do. And
did you vote for him on the gay marriage issue?
No. I'm a straight adult male, but I'm a young person, and so on social issues, I tend to be more liberal. It's issue by issue. I mean, I'm very conservative on gun control and immigration issues. And, you know, his appeal toward the middle class and the working poor sounded great. I thought Obamacare sounded great in theory. In practice, it's a disaster. And so I would have voted for Mitt Romney had I been able to go back and do it again. That's exactly what I would have done.
What you're illustrating is what literally a majority of voters who voted for President Obama, who were in the age group 18 to 25, now say that if they had it to do over, they wouldn't vote for him again. When we come back, more on advice of what to do and what not to do for presidential contenders for 2016. Your call's coming up.
The Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com.
Five minutes after the hour on the Michael Medved Show, your chance to save big, big money. How? By going to MedvedHistoryStore.com, checking out the new pricing, which is very substantially lower on MP3 downloads and on CDs. And yes, including our brand new history show, The Truth About JFK. Go to MedvedHistoryStore.com. We're talking about the next presidential candidate to make history, and what Republicans should and should not do. And one of the great things that Karl Rove calls attention to is that there are a number of potential Republican candidates where the most important thing they have to do is win re-election as governors, including John Kasich. He lists Susana Martinez, Rick Snyder, Brian Sandoval, governor of Nevada, and Scott Walker, of course. Paul Ryan also has to win an election while leading the GOP in congressional budget battles and maybe a congressional budget agreement. At least that's the flurry of news reports today. Let's go to your calls to Mark in Tampa, Florida. Mark, you're on the MedVed Show.
Good afternoon. I think that we had better find a way to unite Republicans, or the same thing is going to happen. And I was just thinking about a simple platform, something that everybody can agree with. How about less government, more freedom?
Well, I think it needs to be a little bit more specific than that, but that's the right idea. And there's no question that Republicans, if they are going to succeed, have to enlarge the party, not drive people out of it, and unite everybody and get people involved. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Greg in Orange County, California. Greg, you're on the Michael Medved Show. Hello, Greg. Nope, we don't have Greg. Okay, let's go to John in Chicago. John, you're on the MedVed Show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking the call. I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you.
Well, I've got two pieces of advice. The first one would be to define your candidacy and why voters should vote for you. And I feel like a large part of the 2012 elections were about why not Obama as opposed to why Mitt Romney. And a great example of that, I think, I believe it was in the 60 Minutes interview. I hate to disagree with the previous caller, but they asked him at the end, what is your candidacy about? And Mitt Romney answered, freedom. And it was just so vague, and it was an answer that I really didn't like, when he really could have hit one out of the park with why he would be a great person to run the country. And then the other piece of advice would be to be calculated about comments that you make that only serve to motivate people whose vote you already have. You know, Todd Akin is somebody that comes to mind specifically, but when you're throwing red meat to the base, you got to be careful not to alienate people that haven't made up their mind yet. And I feel like a lot of times we get foot and mouth syndrome.
You're right. And part of that is because you spend so much time. Part of the problem is the crucial moments here are the general election campaign, except we spend about 10 times as many months and weeks on the primary process, at least five times as much. And the emphasis on persuading new conservatives, that's equally important to winning old ones in this greatest nation on God's green earth.